is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
First thing, are they high character? If they're high character, okay, how talented are they? Number two, are they very talented? Are they A, B? We have different rankings for them. And then do they love basketball? Number three. And if they love basketball, they're willing to kind of what we talked about earlier, be internally motivated. They're willing to watch film. They're that tireless work ethic, core value that we talked about, do stuff outside of what's mandatory, just be gym rats. And if they have all three of those, then it's our job to make sure that they're fitting our program.
Andy Winters is in his third season as the head men's basketball coach at Otterbein University in Westerville, Ohio. Winters came to Otterbein after spending 5 years as the lead assistant at nearby OAC rival Capital University, including the 2015-16 season, as interim head coach. Winters stepped in to serve as interim head coach at Capital after Damon Goodwin took a hiatus to battle leukemia. He was the youngest NCAA head basketball coach at age 25 at that time. Winters spent 1 year at Ohio Dominican University prior to his stint at Capital. Andy was a four-year starter at point guard for Ohio Wesleyan University. He was a three-time All-North Coast Athletic Conference selection, a member of the NCAC All-Decade team. He broke all of Ohio Wesleyan's assist records, participated in the NABC All-Star Game, and ended his senior season with first-team All-American honors. He was also voted the Regional Player of the Year by the NABC, D3Hoops.com, and D3 News after ranking top 5 nationally in assists. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at drdishbball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Dan DeCrane from Gilmore Academy, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly. Mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out quickcut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. Quickcut is undeniably more affordable. It's all cloud-based and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest-growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit quickcut.com/basketball. That's quickcut.com. Have your notebook ready as you listen to this episode with Andy Winters, head men's basketball coach at Otterbein University in Westerville, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome to the podcast this evening Andy Winters, the head men's basketball coach at Otterbein University here in the state of Ohio. Andy, welcome to the Hoop Heads Pod.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Excited to have you on. Want to get a chance to dive into all the things that you've been able to do in the game from your time as a player to what you've been able to accomplish already in your young career as a coach. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us how you first got into the game of basketball.
Yeah, so, you know, my family is pretty athletic-minded. My dad is a longtime high school coach in Columbus. He coached at multiple high schools around the area before getting into administration and then just actually recently retiring. And having an older brother and older sister, you know, they did everything, football, basketball, baseball, and track, and soccer. And so I was always around it, but you know, when from a young age, I just really enjoyed basketball. We have a half court in our backyard. My dad used to run some kids camps for some extra money to take us on vacations. You know, because private school teachers, you know, they don't make the greatest of money. So we kind of, you know, had our kids camps with my dad, and I was always playing up with my brother's team, my sister's team, who are both 8 and 5 years older than I am. So just grew up around the game and ultimately fell in love with it, just enjoyed it. It made sense to me, you know, at a younger age. I just happened to be around, you know, when my dad was coaching and going to all these different camps at different high schools, and just really enjoyed it and had a lot of fun with it. And I think that's the biggest thing to getting somebody like myself is I had fun with it first before I figured that that's what I want to do.
What's your favorite memory of watching or being around your dad's teams when you were a kid?
Yeah, well, you know, so my brother, this is a great story, and I was probably too young to remember this because they told me, but, you know, my dad was at Bishop Watterson High School, and they you know, had a good team, and they said, all right, hey, Matt, you're going to, you know, run and lead the team out, you know, of the locker room, and you know, it's a crowded game, packed. Well, they had another Matt on their team that was a varsity senior. And my brother comes running out and leading the team, but just being around the guys and stuff. I mean, he'd have them over for film and, you know, just being around them and having relationships with those players and always being in the gym, you know, like always watching, you know, him and you know, all those teams that he was involved with kind of throughout the years. That's what I remember the most is just constantly in the gym and watching, having relationships with guys.
When did you start to realize that you had a lot more gym access than your friends? Because obviously that's just what you knew when you were a kid is, hey, dad's got the keys to the gym. We could be there anytime we want, but most kids don't have that experience. When did that kick in for you and start to realize like, hey, I got a pretty special situation here that my dad's coaching at the high school?
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, so by the time I was really getting into it, he had become a principal at a school, Bishop Hartley, on the east side of Columbus. And that was about a 15-minute drive, but he got the key for me to get into Watterson, which is about 5 minutes from our house. And I don't think it was until high school that I realized how lucky I was to have this gym access. You know, we'd be bored and say, hey, let's get into the gym. Or, you know, he has a half court for us in our backyard, and, you know, it'd be middle of the winter, he'd be rebounding for us, you know. And just understanding after – you know, that this isn't everybody's life. You know, I mean, my buddies would all come over and they'd hang out because we had a half court and we could play basketball all night, you know, and that grew a bond and relationships with a lot of my friends kind of growing up into high school that stuck with basketball too, was just with that experience at a young age, you know, having access to it. It was special and it was great. It was a great childhood and basketball was such a big part of it.
At what point in your schooling did you start to maybe take the game from it's just, hey, it's fun to, hey, I really want to work at this and get better? Do you remember there was a moment where you kind of crossed that threshold, or did it sort of happen gradually?
Yeah, well, I just remember in eighth grade going into high school. So there's these feeder schools that feed into Watterson as a private Catholic school. And you know, I just remember there's a moment my brother was actually, he played at High Dominican, but he had yet to start that. So he kind of took a gap year. He was helping out with our eighth grade team. I remember vividly having a conversation where he was, you know, 5 years old and more experienced. He'd already played in high school, telling me that I'm not taking this very serious. You know, I was more for going to the gym and goofing off with my buddies and, you know, just being good just because I was fortunate enough to have basketball my whole childhood and a lot of guys didn't. But I say it really didn't take me until, you know, going into college to figure out how serious I needed to work at it. You know, how much time and what it actually meant to me. I think I was probably too comfortable with some of that stuff. And then getting out of my comfort zone, going into college and making sure I proved myself was probably the best thing for me, you know, as far as learning what it actually takes to be a good player and putting in the time.
Before we jump into your college experience and talk a little bit about your recruitment and then maybe how what you went through, you're able to then utilize now as a head coach, either with conversations with your current players or conversations with recruits. I would definitely want to get into that. Before we do, just tell me what's your favorite memory from high school playing at that time. And then when did you start to realize that, hey, I think I'm going to have an opportunity to play beyond high school?
Yeah. You know, in high school, you know, probably the best memory. We knocked our team was like 500 going into the tournament. We played a really hard schedule. So we're a Division II school, playing a lot of Division I area teams and the Catholic Central League. At the time, I had some really good teams, a couple of which made to the regional finals. We were 500, and we ended up getting to the regional finals at the Cintas Center when it just opened. And knocking off the number one team in the state on a game winner in the semis to get to the finals, and then ultimately lost that the next game to Thurgood by 2. But just that memory of growing up with a lot of these guys, being, you know, playing youth basketball with them, traveling around different leagues, and then all being on the same team. You know, they all stuck with it, and just having those memories of beating those teams or knocking off the number one team in the state to get to the finals. It was just special. And because of the moment, but it was also just all those memories that you had that flooded in, you know, from the previous time.
When did college get on your radar? When did college basketball become a goal, something you were really thinking about?
You know, I grew up watching small college basketball, and I didn't know the difference between divisions. You know, like I would go to all these camps. I thought Otterbein, you know, where I'm currently at, the Otterbein Capital Rivalry. I mean, I was going to games there because my dad had friends on staff that coached. And I thought, like, this is the coolest thing in the world. And I don't even know if I realized in high school, you know, what that meant. I just knew I wanted to play, you know, at the next level because I didn't know what else I'd do with myself. And so I didn't get recruited barely at all. I mean, I got a letter from a school, you know, and got a campus visit from a school in the Heartland, and then I got our assistant coach from Watterson at the time had played at Ohio Wesleyan and told their coach, and I think they had, you know, knew about me, but told them that, hey, there's somebody that you should take a look at, and they didn't come and see me during my season until an All-Star game. I just knew I wanted to be somewhat close to home. Family's important to me. Being around Columbus, I thought it was that's what I wanted. I wanted to be around, you know, people that I knew. And Ohio Wesleyan just made the best fit. So I really only got recruited by two schools, and very fortunate. Now reflecting on all this stuff, and especially when I talk to recruits currently about how lucky I was to just find the right fit without even knowing what I was looking for. And that was a huge part of it. And Coach DeWitt and I are very close, and I'm very fortunate that they reached out and trusted in me, you know, to come be a part of their program. But I wanted to play. I just, whatever it took, as Ohio West and Ohio State, I wanted to get an opportunity to play at the next level. And I knew how good, you know, Division III teams were, Division II teams were just by growing up around it. And I was just happy to be, you know, given an opportunity at that point.
All right. So two questions. First one is, when you say, okay, it happened to be the right fit, you kind of fell into it accidentally. Obviously, the coaching staff is a part of what made it a great fit. What else about Ohio Wesleyan besides the coaching staff made it a good fit for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, so much of it is the people in the program. You know, a really good friend of mine, Robbie Gardner, was a senior. He's coached at, you know, multiple Division II schools, and actually he's not doing it right now. But there's really good people in the program that talked about, you know, how it, like, if you want to be good, what it takes. And I was a freshman at the time, not really understanding, and they were seniors. So that was very fortunate, is the people that were in the program. They just came off a Sweet 16 a couple years prior to me getting there. And that was kind of Coach DeWitt's, you know, that was a really, really good team that he had recruited, and they worked hard through some ups and downs. And that was the first thing. The second thing was really like the style of play and the freedom to be, you know, myself as a player. I was not a good shooter. I was very average athletically. I had some decent vision and ball handling and good IQ because I was a coach's son. But them trusting and allowing me to make mistakes my freshman year and still play and do a bunch of things and have some freedom to grow and develop in the moment was really the thing that made me, you know, where my career ended up. That's really what you know, probably is the biggest significant impact on my playing career was going through that stuff my freshman year and getting some confidence that I can do this.
And then you mentioned earlier that it was really when you got to college that you started to look around and say, hey, I got to maybe take this a little bit more seriously if I want to do what I hope to do with my college career. So what did that look like, let's say the summer after your freshman year, when you start thinking about, okay, how am I going to get better? How am I going to improve? What do I need to do in order to have the best possible career that I have? What did your workouts look like? What did your summer plan look like for getting better?
Yeah, that's something I talk about our guys all the time. So, you know, fast forward from that, going into my senior years when it really clicked. So my freshman year, I started and we had a pretty good team. You know, we were a little bit above 500. Sophomore year, better. Junior year, we made the NCAA tournament for the first time since, you know, they got to the Sweet 16. And then senior year, we hosted the NCAA tournament, won the conference championship, and had a big senior class that was, you know, just experienced and had guys that had done it. But going back to my freshman year, I thought I was working hard, Mike. Like, I try to tell our guys all the time, the perception of a coach watching me work out versus what I thought I was doing. And don't get me wrong, I had a dad that's a coach. So I was in the gym and I was doing a lot of stuff and I was working out with guys. I'll tell you this, I was always playing, you know, whether or not I was doing the right skill work or not. You know, I'd be down at Ohio State's campus at the cages all growing up from, you know, middle school, high school, and even college, playing against just everybody who used to show up. And they've since shut that down, probably because guys would be out there till 2 a.m. And then, you know, and I was always playing open gyms or finding places to play or getting R5 and going over there. I just hated losing. And I think that helped that competition. But as far as, you know, working on my skill, that really didn't click for me until going into my senior year. I was always getting better, but it was like, all right, I have 1 year left. Am I maximizing every possible moment? Am I in the gym? Okay, I got a workout before. Well, did I get a workout after? Did I get a second workout in the morning? You know, if we have a early practice or a late practice, what am I doing with my time and how good that I want to be? And ultimately, if I was better, my team would be better. And that took me till my senior year to realize that, the team goes as your better players work hard and continue to improve, but they really need to maximize their time and they really need to work on it. And it's actually morphed into one of our core values as a coach now. I call it our tireless work ethic. You know, and the word tireless we talk about is, what are you doing outside of what's mandatory? You know, what are you doing that's, you know, making you better outside of what the coaches are asking you to do if you want to set yourself apart? And so a lot of these things that I'm talking about is kind of morphed into my coaching philosophy. And I talk to our recruits when they come in about, I say, hey, look, you know, learn from my experience, like figure it out now going into your sophomore year, going into your freshman year, what it takes, you know, in the culture of our program, I hope is pushing guys to realize that earlier, as opposed to maybe when it clicked for me going into my senior year, because I knew I had 1 year left.
What does the pickup basketball scene look like for your guys when you're having conversations with them and they're trying to improve? Because one of the things that I think has changed, and you mentioned it, getting shut down and outdoor courts and just the things that used to be around. You're a lot younger than me, but you know, when I played, basically it was, you could find games anywhere and everywhere. You just had to know where guys were going to be on a given day, which gym or which playground or whatever.
and you could always find high quality pickup games. And I feel like now it's much more difficult for kids to find that. So when you're having conversations with your players, where are they finding games?
Yeah, agreed. I talked to them about hosting games. You know, I said like, because I agree. I'm not that old, so I'm not trying to sound older than I am. But even then, like, I didn't have a trainer. I didn't have somebody that worked me out. I didn't have a skills guy. I just went and played, and I went to open gyms all over Columbus. We'd drive 45 minutes to go find a game and bring a five. I think part of it is, you know, if it's in your identity and who you are and that you're always trying to get better and love the game of basketball and you're passionate about it, you know, you can find other guys that want to do that. I just think it's less and less because there's less opportunities. I don't see anybody playing outside anymore. I don't see, open gyms where anybody can come. And so we talked to our guys about, you know, okay, in the summer, why don't you guys host two or three open gyms a week? You know, and bring teams from, you know, Division II team from Columbus and Division III team from, you know, wherever, Division I team, bring a five and have four or five teams that come and play each other. You know, be the people that host that, because in college, I think it's hard to find open gyms. I think it's hard to find open gyms anywhere, but at the level that you need it to be in college with the amount of people who, you know, as you guys know, it's less than 4% that go on to play college basketball. So, you know, finding, you know, an open gym is great, but to the level that you need it to be at and the players that you're trying to play against. So we just talked to our guys about trying to host it and figure out ways to bring guys in and attract guys. And they've done a really, really good job of that now in our third year of that kind of being the expectation, where these open gyms are very important. And if we treat them right and we bring in, you know, great competition, this is getting us all better. And it's good for college basketball in Columbus on top of it.
Absolutely. How much time do you spend at the end of your season having conversations with your players? Obviously, you're talking about that open gym piece, but then there's also the piece of, hey, here's the skill work that we'd like you to be working on, the things that you need to do and get better. And obviously, part of that is a recruiting piece where you're bringing in guys that hopefully are going to be the type of players that want to be in the gym, want to be improving, want to get better. And that starts right with who you recruit and bring into right your program, obviously. But when you're having those conversations, are you giving them, hey, here's a couple of different workouts, things that you should be considering doing? Are you giving them, hey, these are the skills you need to work on, kind of figure out what works for you in order to improve those? What do those end of season conversations look like for you with your kids?
Yeah, well, so with Division III, we can't have a basketball outside of our season. And so a lot of this, like you mentioned, is being internally motivated. But I think even more so than that is we talk about the clarity of vision. You know, cultures have clarity of vision. Everybody believes in the standard. Everybody believes in the expectations. And then they can articulate, you know, what those are. And so us as a coaching staff, we need to do a great job of making sure we, you know, explain, okay, some guys, it's like, hey, let's just get better at your strengths. You're a great shooter. Well, let's shoot 45, 50% from the 3-point line instead of 40. You know, like that's what you're going to do really well. I think sometimes guys are working on their weaknesses or doing things that they can't do, trying to develop themselves when ultimately it's like, where are they in their career and what does the team need them to do? Right. And if we're all worried about, you know, moving this thing forward as a team, then we all have to figure out what we can do in our role to be better for the team. And so we talk a lot about that. And then we talk, you know, to our guys about, you know, what's a good workout? You know, what am I working on? And we try to also use our practice skill sessions pre-post or during practice for them to learn drills, you know, and things that are game-like skill work that they can then do on their own. Because as much as we want to say, hey, go do skill, most guys don't know what to do. You know, so we have to educate them. We have to have this clarity of vision through our practice time, using that as prep for off-season stuff so that we can say, hey, you know, hit the Chris Quinn drill, you know, a drill I learned from Chris Quinn when I was working. I got to do a skill session with them. Okay, those guys know exactly what that is, and they can knock it out and make sure that, you know, they're getting the most out of their time and being efficient, especially in the spring and summer where there's a lot going on.
Absolutely. I love that, the idea that you're not just saying, okay, here's some drills you should do, and I got them diagrammed on a piece of paper, or I'm sending them to you in a file, or here's a right video. These are right things that they've actually already done.
Correct.
That makes it much easier for them to then take that and understand sort of the intensity and the little details that you have in order to really improve and get better. To me, that makes a ton of sense. I don't know if I've ever heard any coach say specifically that I mean, I'm sure that a lot of coaches are doing that, but I like the way that you phrased it just to make sure that people understand that, look, you can put those drills into your skill development part of your practices during your season, and then boom, right. Now your players already have those in their tools. You know, they already have that in the tool set, so they can go out, and when it's time in the summer for them to get better and work on it, they already know exactly what they should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we talk about keeping it simple too. Like, you don't have a gun at your high school. Okay, well, you know, like, here's all the drills that we've done without a gun. You know, here's, you know, you can only get an outside workout because you're on vacation. Well, here's the things that we work on, you know, with a hoop and a ball. So just figuring out different ways to keep it simple, and the guys making sure they understand and then can articulate what they're supposed to do has been the best thing for our skill development.
Yeah, I could totally see that. I mean, it makes complete sense to me when I think about having a tool set of things that I can work on. I've said this on the podcast a bunch of times, but when I was a kid, Andy, I just did the same. I had two workouts. I had a workout I did when I was by myself.
Right.
And then I had a workout that I would do if I was fortunate enough to either have somebody that wanted to shoot with me or somebody to rebound. And that was it. I mean, my level of creativity when I look back on it was like zero. Yeah. So, I mean,
you're a good player, though.
I guess that's probably true. Going back to your point of get good at the things you're good at, I guess after doing the same workout for like 8 years, I could probably got pretty good at it by the time I was a senior in college. I was probably good at those particular skills, but
right.
It makes you wonder, like, what could I have done with some of the things that we have today, some of the right. the tools that are out there for people, but
the apps and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of crazy. Just my access to a gym was very limited. I did spend a lot of time, especially when I was younger, on the playgrounds as opposed to being in a gym. Eventually got there, but it's a different world without question. One of the things that struck me that you said earlier was talking about how you didn't really understand or recognize the different levels of college basketball. It's just kind of like, hey, I want to play college basketball. And because you had grown up around the Division III, Division II game, that was just sort of what you knew. Whereas obviously a lot of kids, there's this Division I mentality that if I have aspirations of playing in college, most kids don't think about playing Division III. Most kids are thinking about playing Division I because that's what they see all the time. So I think one of the things that we've talked to a couple of Division III coaches as they've been recruiting players, they've told us that a lot of their kids that they end up talking to have never even seen a Division III basketball game. They've never even gone and watch, right. And here they are being recruited by a Division III program. So how do you, as you're recruiting, what are those conversations like with kids? Because obviously the kids that you'd like to bring into your program are probably kids who maybe they have a Division II offer, or maybe they're a kid that could potentially play at a higher level if they found the exact right scenario. And those are the kinds of kids that if you can get them to Otterbein, obviously that makes your program that much stronger. So just what are those conversations like when you're recruiting, when you have a kid who's kind of vacillating between, hey, should I stretch myself and go to that one Division II school that's maybe given me an offer, or should I go and play Division III where maybe I can be a player that is going to be able to play and start and do some of the things that maybe we all dream of being able to do as a player?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think you can take it in so many different ways. Is some kids are, you know, they're scholarship chasing and that's what they want. They've made up their mind on it. But I think the majority of the kids we recruit, and yes, we do. We go after, you know, scholarship kids all the time that are kind of on that border that talk about, you know, what's best for them. And it's first, it's educating them and showing them the level, you know, getting them in a gym, see a practice, see a game, see the level. Most of the guys on our team are coming from all state, all district, you know, and so there is a, you know, very high level to begin with, as you know. So it's educating them and making sure they understand it. And then I think the next thing is talking about really about development and going where you are wanted, and then who's going to develop you. You know, and we go even deeper than not just a player, but as a person, as a student, you know, all those type of things. But if we're talking basketball specific, you know, who's going to go and going back to my experience and just reflecting on it, had gone to a school that wasn't the right fit, I tried to do some type of walk-on thing, I'm sitting on the bench, I'm not sure I would have, you know, grown as a player and put in the type of, you know, I hope I would have, you know, I like it because I tell our guys this, but like, getting that chance to see some good things happen, and whether it's just practice or in a game, helps you continue to develop. And so we talk to our guys about the importance of development as a player and growing over your 4 years. And there's a lot of guys who are seniors and at the Division III levels or fifth years that have opportunities to play after if that's what they want. You know, and there's a lot of guys who go to the wrong fit, end up transferring or quitting just because they had a bad experience and it was, maybe the wrong level or not the best choice that they could have made at the time. And sometimes it is. I'm not trying to say one way or the other, but I just think educating recruits on, the level of Division III, coming to an OAC basketball game and watching our conference. And then where are the coaches that are really going to have a relationship with you and develop you over your next 4 years and make you the best person, player that you can be? And ultimately, that's where you're going to be the most successful at.
To go along with that, obviously, as a player, when you step into a program, you're hopeful that you're going to get an opportunity to play right away. But that clearly doesn't happen for every player that you bring into your program. So for a kid who comes to Otterbein and ends up, let's say, in their freshman year, they're a bench player. Maybe they get a few minutes here and there, and they're not maybe getting the role that they had hoped for when they first got there. What do those conversations look like? Because obviously, there's lots of kids who don't play very much as a freshman or don't play very much as a sophomore. And then by the time they're a junior or senior, and they've developed and they've put in the work, and then they get their opportunity. But sometimes kids can get lost in that first year or two when they're not playing as much as they'd like to. So what do those conversations look like for you and your staff when you have a kid who's maybe not playing as much as they would like, especially an underclassman, that you feel like, hey, this kid's going to develop. They're going to eventually be an important part of our program. But right now, they're not quite ready. What do those conversations sound like?
Well, going through it currently, we have some really good freshmen that aren't playing a ton of minutes right now in our third year as a staff. And part of it is okay. And it's the same thing we tell our team about not being results based. It's about, are we perfecting our daily habits? Are we working to strive to our core values of competitive greatness, where, we have a championship approach to everything that we do? Are we selfless in what we're trying to do, where this is, it's that we versus me, it's that family, forget about me, I love you, FAMILY, that loyalty to a team is that the third core value of a tireless work ethic that I kind of talked about of doing outside of what's mandatory. Am I instilling those core values in myself? And then am I taking each of these days that I have and figuring a way to get better and improve on my daily habits? Because ultimately that's going to come back, to help you. And so even though you're not seeing it, or let's say you lose a couple games, as a coach, I have to remind myself, like, what are we doing today, to make our team better? Same thing as a player. I didn't get in. I'm not in the rotation. There's a lot of things you can improve on, and I think the thing we fight as coaches is freshmen being complacent and okay with their role. Not that you want them to be bad teammates, but being competitive every single day. And that is really hard because, whether you've won a couple games and your lineup set and guys are kind of playing well together, are you still, as that freshman, putting in the time to set yourself up and not wasting days? And if you are, you're going to get your chance. And when you get your chance, you're going to be ready. But it's hard, and we have constant conversations about that with our freshmen because they're going to be really good players. It's just right now there's one or two things that somebody else does better than them. It doesn't mean that it won't change midway through the year or at the end of the year. So you just got to continue to improve and work on your daily habits.
I think back to when I played, and as a freshman, I barely played at all. By the end of the season, I was maybe getting a couple minutes here and there, but that was definitely the longest season of my basketball career, without question. You go from being a high school player, obviously you're the best player on your team, and you're getting all the opportunities to kind of do whatever you want. And then suddenly you get to college and you're like, whoa, this isn't the same as it was before, and I got to figure this thing out. And it's tough. And it's tough when you don't play. It's tough to go and put in that work and do the things that you need to do when you're not getting – there's no carrot at the end of that stick for you. It's just, hey, I got to keep doing this, even though my moment in the sun may not come until next year, or may not come until 2 years from now. And I think what you just said is critical, Andy, and that is that you got to keep having those conversations, and you got to help those kids see the big picture, and you got to let them know what they are contributing, because all it takes is something, just a little something from the coach can oftentimes just be enough to get another hour or another day or another week or another 2 weeks or another month out of a kid of like, hey, I see you over there. I see you working. I see you getting better at this.
Right.
And you know, your opportunity is coming at some point. To me, that's really so important. And I think it's something that I think coaches are probably better at that today than they used to be, just because we're so focused, and coaches, I think, are much better at communicating sort of the why and the thought process behind what they do than they used to be. When you think about maybe, you know, guys from your dad's era or guys that I grew up playing for.
The Bob Knight disciple science, right?
Exactly. It was just like, you're going to do this because you're going to do it and because I said so, and I don't really have to share with you the why. And so I think we as coaches do a much better job of that today. Let's work backwards. Go back to when you're at Ohio Wesleyan, and what are you thinking about doing for your career? Were you a guy that always knew you wanted to coach because your dad was a coach and you love the game, or were you focused on being a player and then all of a sudden you get done and you're like, oh man, like what am I going to do? Maybe I got to get into coaching so I can stay in the game.
Yeah. Well, I think like a lot of players in the moment, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I loved basketball. So my family being in education, that's why I coach and teach, right? Like, and funny how I put coach before teach. and I did my student teaching, and I just wasn't enjoyable at all. I liked the people I was around. I just, I was like, you know what? If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it while I'm young and have the opportunity to put in some hours and work hard and, you know, see something happen. And high school is a great level too. I wanted to coach full time, and I wanted to be around players and have relationships constantly where they're in my office or I'm doing skill work, I'm watching film, instead of, you know, getting a prep ready for something that I'm not that interested in teaching. And so I was doing education, and, you know, I had a lot of long conversations, and thankfully I was talking about my brother. He's actually on staff. He's my assistant. I had a lot of calls with him because he's 5 years older, and I talked about, you know, I was like, I don't know if I want to do this. He was teaching in high school at the time and coaching. And he was like, I can see that. He's like, listen, if I were to do it again, I probably would have tried to start in college and go that route. And I talked to my dad about that, and he kind of had the same advice. And so from there, it was like, listen, do I have a chance to play overseas or do something? Yeah, possibly. Is that ultimately what I want to do with my life? You know, I don't think so. I'm a homebody. I'm not sure. I probably would have got cut anyways, but I'm not sure I could have lasted a full year somewhere, you know. And so I decided to get into coaching, and you know, didn't really matter what level to me at the time. I just wanted to, you know, be a part of something and coach my first year, you know, whatever that meant. I knew that I wanted to have a part of a program, helping with scouting, helping with player personnel. I didn't want to, you know, go on coffee runs. Not that, you know, that I shouldn't have done that, but I wanted to be involved in it right away. And that's what kind of probably led me to Ohio Dominican in the Division II level. You know, when I finished playing.
How did that opportunity come across your desk? How'd you get the opportunity to get to Ohio and Dominican?
Yeah, fortunate with that as well. So Dan Evans, who's actually now the head coach at North Georgia Division II, he was going into his first year, and they, so the previous staff had just been replaced, and it was one of those things where I was sending some emails out to just some local teams, and I was having Coach DeWitt reach out, and I met with our athletic director at the time at Ohio Wesleyan about, you know, hey, I want to do this. You know, can you guys help get me something? Just get me an in. I'll volunteer. I'll live at home. I'll do whatever I need to do. I don't have to get paid, you know. And so I sent an email. They didn't have a graduate assistant at the time, but Dan got back to me pretty quickly. You know, and he was he wasn't from around Ohio. He's out of state, and I think he liked having somebody from Columbus on his staff, with Ohio Dominican being in Columbus, and so he hired me as a second assistant. I got paid, you know,
Hell, I can't even remember. It was so
big,
little.
Big money, yeah, right, Andy?
That's
big
right,
money.
That's right. Big money. I just remember Court Hamilton was the assistant at the time, who actually came over from Capital University, as he was the assistant then. And him buying me lunch almost every day because I couldn't afford it. I'm still grateful, and I still pay that back because I think I never remember how important that was. But you know, I got to take some classes for my master's, and they paid for some of those out of their, you know, fundraising budget. But I got to be a second assistant. I got to be hands on, and that's what I wanted. I just wanted the opportunity to showcase my skills and what I could do, and also learn and grow from really good coaches.
What do you think you were good at right out of the gate? And then what's something you think you were pretty bad at that you've improved a lot since you started?
Yeah, I think I was better at some of the player development skill stuff just because of, you know, going through it and being younger, and I could jump in with it. I could guard them. I could do a bunch of things, you know, where they're reading, reacting to defense, you know, instead of just being on a cone, and having relationships with guys as a younger coach, you know, of, you know, being able to understand and talk to them about, you know, what they could do to get better and why they're not playing or this or that. And, so I felt like I was pretty good at that. I was not very good at understanding, you know, how practices work. You know, like the flow of practices or you know, I just went like, come on, we got to keep grinding or do this or do a drill for 45 minutes when practice is only an hour 40 because the girls are on after us, right? Like I was young and dumb, and not that I'm any smarter now, but I'm a little bit older. And I just knew that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you have to get accomplished. And funny thing is, you know, my interim head coaching year at Capital, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about that, but that's where I probably grew the most as a coach, being thrown into the fire at 25 years old. And I was the youngest coach in NCAA at the time. And, that was an experience that I think only could have prepared me for my first year at Otterbein.
All right, so let's get there to Capital. After your year at Ohio Dominican, you get an opportunity to go to Capital, and just tell us a little bit about the process of leaving Ohio Dominican and getting to Capital.
Yeah, so Ohio Dominican coming into there was, you know, Division II school. They had just gone to NCAA Division II not too many years prior to us getting there, and had really struggled. And we landed a couple big time Columbus recruits that were on the border of Division I and Division II, just like you try to do at the Division III level. And they ultimately went on to you know, win a conference championship tournament, getting in the NCAA tournament after 4 years. And then I came over to Capital after my first year at Ohio Dominican, and I was actually the lead assistant at the time. The gentleman took another job, actually took a high school head coaching job, and I got promoted and was very grateful. And then I got a call from Capital that, you know, hey, their assistant left as well. And I just always enjoyed Division III. I don't know what it was about. It was the purity of basketball. It was the type of guys we were recruiting. I really enjoyed it, and I thought I wanted to get back to that level. In my first year at Capital, we were 8-18 as an assistant coach, and I got hired late in August, and, you know, we didn't have a great year. And then Damon Goodwin, the head coach currently, thankfully he's okay now, but he had leukemia during our second year. And so we found out right before our first scrimmage that Damon wasn't going to be our coach for that year, and he was going to take a year off and get healthy. And so they promoted me to a head coach, interim head coach at 25. We had a 24-year-old transfer on the team. And then we had a 22-year-old transfer from Ohio Dominican on the team. And then we had a bunch of freshmen and a couple other upperclassmen that played. And yeah, it was one of those things where you think you're ready, but you're really not. And, you know, we'll figure it out. And part of it was you don't want to mess up for Damon and for Capital. And obviously it's a strong program historically. You wanted to continue to do what's right by then. So you kind of had your own coaching touch, but you wanted to carry over a lot of the stuff that you've been doing, because ultimately it's not about you. It's about the program. And the next year we are, you know, that's what we're going to do when Damon gets healthy. So it was a very unique year in balancing a lot of that stuff. A lot of older guys, younger guys. My first recruiting class were freshmen who ultimately went on to win the league their senior year. So that was kind of cool to see at Ohio Dominican in Capital of programs that are rebuilding that have success after a couple of recruiting classes and sticking with it.
What did that conversation look like when Damon decides to step away? Is that a conversation between you and him? Is that a conversation between you and the athletic director? Is that a combination of all of that? Just what did they tell you? What were you thinking in that moment as that opportunity comes to you?
Yeah, so Damon called me and he told me, he said, "I'm done." He said, I'm not coaching this year. You're gonna have to take over." And it was pretty emotional talking to him because, you know, you didn't know. It was the unknown of what was going to happen for him. You know, basketball kind of didn't seem as important at the time. And then the very next day, I'm meeting with the athletic director and saying, "All right, hey, this is what you're doing. You do not have a full-time assistant." You know, thankfully, I had another guy who was a part-time guy, Anthony Golson, who had been a head coach at, you know, previous places, was there with me. And you got a game here in a week. You know, so it was like, all right, let me figure out what the hell I'm doing and try to prepare. And so we had team meetings and constant, you know, conversations with players about the whole transition. And I think the biggest thing that helped me with it was that I had a year prior under my belt as the assistant, because I think, you know, players, when they know that you work hard and you're knowledgeable about what you're trying to do, it's a little bit easier to coach them. You know, I think when they see you're prepared and they see you put in the time and they know that you love them and you care for them, it's a little bit easier to transition that. And that's thankfully what made it, you know, a smooth transition. I was a terrible coach. And I apologize to those guys every time I see them, because I think we could have probably been pretty good, even though we improved on wins from the previous year and improved in every statistical category. We should have, because we had good players, and I just wasn't prepared in the moment. But I'll tell you what I learned, you know, probably the most. I have a lot of young head coaches that call me and say, "Hey, you know, what you know," or young assistants that want to be head coaches, or, you know, I said, you truly can prepare and have all this stuff down. It's so important going through that year, because you're probably not worrying about basketball as much as you think.
What was the biggest challenge that you faced that season in terms of just stepping from the assistant's role into the head coaching role? Was it the fact that you were an interim coach? Was it just trying to put things together on the fly, since you're going and had obviously no time to really prepare for getting it all together? What do you remember as being the biggest challenge during that season?
Yeah, I think a combination of all of it. You know, we started off like 7-3 and ended up 12-14 after we came back from Christmas break. And I think it was adjusting as a young head coach and figuring out, you know, I thought I was a good in-games coach where I could make some adjustments, but I was not a good practice-to-practice coach. I wasn't good at changing up or keeping drills fresh or keeping competition. You know, we had our guys that we figured were probably the better players, but when they didn't play well, you know, are you allowing those other guys opportunities? Are you changing up your drills? Are you, you know, doing all those things from a basketball standpoint that's going to develop and help them prepare for whatever situations in a game? And I just wasn't there. We did a lot of the same drills every single day, and practices just came, you know, a little bit monotonous. And I think we still did skill work, and I still, you know, tried to do all that. But I just remember that being, I was really frustrated with myself when I reflected on it. But a funny story is, I'll tell you, besides that, our first game, I forgot I was the head coach. Like, I knew I was the head coach, but I didn't know I could stand up because I hadn't done it. So I'm sitting there and I'm looking down the bench, and some ref made a call, and I'm yelling at him while I'm sitting down. And then I turn around, it's been about 2 minutes. I said, "Damn, I can stand up, I guess," and walk a little bit. So just those small things that you don't think of. And it was a great experience. And I think, you know, the practice planning, I was always pretty decent with relationships. I felt pretty confident in that, and meeting with players and doing all that. But it was the interim stuff, like you mentioned, where you're doing some of what Capital's always done with some of the stuff that you think you should do, but trying to maintain that program, you know, for the next year and the following year, and how they're going to get better each year. So it's kind of a combination of both.
When you think about practice planning, and you mentioned that it was something that you felt like maybe that was a weak spot during that first run there at Capital. So when you get the job at Otterbein, you start thinking about how you want to put together your practices to be able to maximize the benefit for your players as individuals and then obviously for your team. What does your practice planning process look like today?
Yeah, so I think what's helped is you know, you pull as a young coach, you're pulling all these different drills that you saw or that you liked or somebody did that at practice, but does it make sense for you? So being knowledgeable enough to have drills that you can do and things that carry over to games, but also, you know, keeping stuff that makes sense to what you're trying to do offensively and defensively or culturally, you know, and I think that was, you know, having the knowledge to know what you need to work on, know your strengths, know your weaknesses, being able to have a program. I mean, my first year at Otterbein, I did not know what I wanted to do, like offensively and defensively looking back on it. I thought I did, you know, just because of, you know, what I've done in the past or as a player or what I've researched. But when you kind of see it and it's not working to what you thought it would be, being able to change and have the vision for, you know, not that year, but maybe for 2 or 3 years down the road. And we've kind of completely changed what we are doing since our first year. And that involves even into our practices. I mean, the biggest thing with Otterbein is I want our practices to be game-like. I want them to be competition. I want to, you know, have the intensity and making sure that we're going, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours about as hard as we can. And we are pushing ourselves to get better and we are making mistakes and we're overcoming adversity during practice. And that's my biggest thing about practice is are we at the intensity that it deserves? In every single day, is our daily habits matching that? And then depending on, you know, I've kind of, you know, got into the flow of practice where now it's, you know, you're doing your skill work or your starter drills, but do they have meaning? And do they translate to what you're doing instead of, you know, maybe doing a drill that has no translation into your offense or defense or even just a cultural drill? I mean, what's the purpose behind it? Why are we wasting time? And I think that's been the biggest thing is that intensity and then having purpose in what we're doing.
How do you make sure that you're getting that competitiveness, that intensity from day to day? Obviously, it's something that you build over time and it becomes an expectation. But when you think about trying to get kids to compete, and we talked a little earlier about a freshman who maybe isn't getting the amount of playing time right that they'd like to have, but yet that's the kid that might be guarding one of your starters for 45 minutes during right practice and has to push that kid to get better. So how do you make sure and maintain that competitive environment? Is there anything specifically you do? Do you chart wins and losses? Do you have, you know, there's a quote unquote punishment. There's a 10 push-up. Everybody hates sure to lose. Just what are some things that you do to just keep the intensity amped up?
Yeah. So multiple things. So first, we talk, you know, we have a team meeting before we start and we talk about culture and Buzz Williams, he's at Texas A&M. When he was at Virginia Tech, I was fortunate enough to work camp and talk to him a lot about culture. And his biggest thing was the culture ball is bigger than the basketball as a head coach. And so, you know, when we talk to our guys, and I've mentioned daily habits and our core values, but we talk about that our culture, you know, is so clear that it's felt and then that other people describe it to you as the player after they see you play. You know, did they talk about you guys, your work ethic? Did they talk about your selflessness, your how hard you competed or your preparation? You know, were they able to explain it? Because if they weren't, then it wasn't felt. And so that's the first thing is making sure we understand that. And that goes to your point. Like, so currently we're 5-1 and our freshmen, you know, they're not getting, some of them aren't getting a ton of playing time, but how valuable it is and what they do every single day to make those starters ready. And so those relationships and those conversations need to be had, but also wins and loss board. We do that every single day. We track wins, losses, and then we give a weekly practice winner, and whoever has the best wins loss percentage, and we move teams and we make it competitive, and we go ones versus twos a lot. We go, you know, different groups and mix up starters and rotation guys, and even shooting drills, even, you know, sprints. Maybe we say, all right, hey, you can get a point, a win, a loss if your team wins. Pre-game shoot around stuff. Everything that we do is competitive. The guys have taken it even further and they actually track their wins and losses on their own on the whiteboard, you know, for open gyms. And so they want to show that, like, hey, I'm playing because I'm always winning. I have a better win-loss percentage than you, you know, and then they want to be that weekly, you know, player of the week during the season that gets to hold a belt. And we have this, you know, kids WWE or whatever it's called now, belt that they wear, and they get to post on Twitter, and they get to have it on social media and say that they were the best this week from a wins-loss percentage. So I think tracking that stuff constantly has helped us. We've just started that in the last year with COVID. We got to do a lot of research on how we can improve as a coaching staff, how our culture can improve. And that's been something that's great for us. And having a staff of, you know, Matt Winters, my assistant, AJ Dixon, who I coached his time at Capital, who he's now over with me, he's 27 and a great young head or young assistant coach. You know, having guys on staff, but not having a ton of them, their energy is contagious, you know, and how can we elevate others as coaches, as players, you know, all of that stuff goes into that intensity of a practice because that's how games need to be. So to answer your question, long-winded, I apologize, all of that.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense. I think one of the things that is always interesting to me is how coaches go about tracking statistics, wins and losses, whether they're charting, shooting, and just how much the players take to it if the coach continues to be intentional about it. I know it's something right. that you have to make sure that it can't be something that you do for a week here and there. It's got to be something that becomes embedded in your program.
Right.
And the kids obviously see it. And then you throw the championship belt in there and boom, now you, exactly. you, know, now you got something. As silly exactly. As silly as it may sound, it's always one of those things that I think the older you get, the more you forget that it really is those silly, what we might consider stupid things that yep. players and kids love and that exactly. they'll almost kill themselves for. I know when I was in high school, I never played for this coach. He was the JV coach and I never played JV basketball, but he would give an orange juice to any kid who took a charge in a game. And so kids would literally kill themselves trying That's to right. take a charge to get an orange. I mean, to get an orange juice.
Right.
And when you say that, it sounds ridiculous, but I can still remember conversations of kids that, you know, when I was a sophomore playing on the varsity and my buddies that were still playing on the JV team, just literally being like, man, I got four orange juices yesterday. Right. I should have seen all these charges I took. And you're like, God, this is so stupid, but but it works. And those are the kinds of things that if you can find the right thing for a particular group of kids, man, you can really get something. You can really get something going for sure.
And to your point, it's also what you emphasize. I think it's when I was a younger coach for anybody who's listening that's younger, I tried to do everything or track everything or do all of this stuff, and it came so much where you know it's almost impossible to continue to do that throughout the entire year. So it was simplifying that and saying, okay, what's really important to us? And ultimately it was like winning and losing, right? That the competitive greatness to always be your best, have a championship approach and okay, you know, getting a mark on the board and that effort and energy and everything that I worked for produced the correct result. And if I continue to do that every single day, you know, good results will come.
Absolutely. You talked a little bit about the energy that your staff brings to the table, and obviously they're helping you, I'm sure, chart all this stuff and get it organized and make sure they know who's getting the belt. But as a head coach, how do you think about delegating responsibilities to your staff? I know we've talked to a lot of coaches at all levels, and one of the things that they always say is that early in my career, I wasn't very good at delegating. I wanted to do everything myself because I had a standard and I sort of selfishly thought nobody else can do it to my standard. So I tried to do everything and I just never empowered my assistants. So how do you think about that in terms of working with your staff and making sure that they have responsibilities and then it takes things off your plate and ultimately improves the program? Just how do you go about your process of delegating to your staff?
Well, that's pretty much my story is what you explained. So when I was an interim head coach, you know, we had a part-time assistant. You know, I was trying to do, you know, the scouts and the practice plan and the recruiting and the kids on campus. I mean, I literally didn't have enough time. And I was actually getting my MBA at the time. So I'd be in class doing the scout while the professor was talking because I just didn't have enough time. And I told myself whenever, if I get the opportunity to become a head coach again, I need to delegate because everybody will be better from it, you know? And you do, you have that thing like, okay, this is finally your program. I have to, you know, do it this way or that way. Well, part of that is making sure you have a staff that you can communicate with and that you can be vulnerable around and saying, hey, look, like this is not a strength of mine, but I think you're really good at this. Why don't you take this and why don't we meet on it quite a bit? You know, whether it's, you know, film sessions, whether it's player development or if it's recruiting or scouting. And so part of my job is making sure our assistants are prepared for when they become a head coach and having those opportunities. And I think my interim head coaching year thankfully fast-tracked me, you know, going into my first year as an actual head coach with Otterbein of delegating and understanding what I do well, what I don't do well, or even if I thought I did it well, he may do it better, you know, and giving them the reps and the trust, and then players now having relationships because they get to go to a coach who's got a different perspective, and they're not always hearing my voice or hearing multiple voices. And these assistants are getting different ways to touch them and talk to them and communicate on something that we've talked about in practice. I think that is the most important thing as a young coach, is being able to delegate and understanding, you know, what's not that it's less important, but what do they do better and what do you do better?
That's something that it takes a lot of sort of self-knowledge to understand your own strengths and weaknesses, because obviously we all tend to know what our strengths are and probably overestimate those. And we probably tend to underestimate the things maybe that we're not good at. And so that ability to self-reflect, I think when I think about myself as a coach, I try to think about what are things that I do well, what are things that I don't do well. And it's hard to sit down and go through and have those conversations in your head and figure out, hey, this is an area that I'm pretty good at. And hey, maybe this is an area that we might be better off having somebody else take over in that particular spot. And that's not easy to do. Obviously, anybody who has success, we all have an ego to some degree.
Sure.
And as the head coach, ultimately, we know that it's your name that's attached to the record and it's your name that's attached to the program.
Right.
And so it's different from being an assistant. Being an assistant and then scooting over that 18 inches on the bench makes a huge difference in terms of just how your what your outlook is and how much responsibility you take for what that program is all about. And so being able to self-reflect to me is a really, really important skill for any coach. When you think about your program at Otterbein, and when you think about what allows a program, specifically at the Division III level, to be successful, what is it beyond the basketball? Let's say in terms of the school, the facilities, the support, what are things that when you're looking at what makes your job and your program have an opportunity to be successful, what are some things outside of basketball that you look for that you think are important to be able to have a successful Division III basketball program?
Yeah, well, I think so much of it at our level is finding the kids that or the recruits that would fit your school. You know, depending on what your school does and where they are and what they do well for Otterbein, we're fortunate to be in Westerville, Ohio, which is 15 minutes outside of Columbus. You know, so we have so many, you know, internship job opportunities. We have alumni that stayed around the area that want to give back and help. And so we're very fortunate from that standpoint of our location. And so we're able to attract certain kids that are looking for that, you know, that right or wrong, depending on what they want to do with their life. Otterbein's attractive to them. I think it's always important with that is being able to know who you are as a school and what your university does well. And so attracting kids academically, you know, socially, getting the right kids, recruiting high character, you know, players first that are very talented, you know, and then love basketball is all part of it. But as a Division III institution, I think you can be successful, you know, if your facilities are good and you have administration that understands the importance of athletics and the balance. But ultimately, if you just really focus on what your school does well and then finding those recruits that would be a great fit, I think is the most important thing. I think you can win if you do that probably at most places. And I believe that wholeheartedly.
Let's talk a little bit about the recruiting piece of it. When you go through the process of recruiting an individual player, maybe take us back to the very beginning. When you're starting to sit down and put together your list of potential players that you may want to start recruiting, what does the process look like right from that beginning of how do you identify players? And then once you identify who it is that you may want to go out and recruit, how often do you go see them play? Are you watching them with their high school team, with their AAU team? What's the balance between those two? Yeah. Just take us through your entire recruiting process from start to finish, identification to getting that kid on campus as a member of your team.
Yeah. So as you know, I mean, recruiting is the lifeblood of any program. So that needs to be a priority, you know, from the get go. And so when I got the job, we called them our OKGs, our kind of guys, the guys that would fit kind of what we were talking about, Otterbein, would fit, you know, our program philosophy, would fit our culture, our staff. And so what we did is, you know, Ohio has really, really good basketball. You don't have to go very far to go, you know, as you know, Columbus, Cleveland, Toledo, Cincinnati, Dayton. I mean, there are some really, really good players. And so we talk about, you know, protecting our backyard in Columbus because we feel like if we're looking at kids and what we do first is we evaluate. So we'll start to, you know, get names and numbers and okay, what are we looking for in this class? You know, and ultimately, I think most Division IIIs, you know, I don't know if I think you can be specific as far as, you know, positions or stuff, but you're always going to get the best available if somebody's better than somebody you have currently, right? Like you're always trying to get those borderline scholarship kids. And we talked to our team about how important competition is in practice, and you want those guys here because everybody's going to grow and get better from it. So the first thing we do is we call them our OKGs, our kind of guys, and we go through, you know, one, are they talented, you know, from a basketball to be on that list? Okay. If they are, it goes to another category, and that category goes, you know, first thing, are they high character? If they're high character, okay, how talented are they? Number two, are they very talented? Are they A, B? We have different rankings for them. And then do they love basketball? Number three. And if they love basketball, they're willing to kind of what we talked about earlier, be internally motivated. They're willing to, you know, watch film. They're that tireless work ethic, core value that we talked about, do stuff outside of what's mandatory, and just be gym rats. And if they have all three of those, then it's our job, you know, to make sure that they're fitting our program. And so from a recruiting standpoint, you know, we need to evaluate early. I think that's important is establishing relationships and contacts with high school coaches, AAU coaches, evaluating, you know, players that we think can fit us and, you know, knowing everybody. I one thing when I was at Ohio Dominican, Dan Evans, who was the head coach at the time, we talked a lot about, you know, you should know everybody on a team and everybody in the roster. And at the time I was like, geez, how many guys is that? But he's right. You need to know everybody and be able to evaluate early, you know, and have guys that some people haven't seen or, you know, just outwork them because you've seen them at practices and gone and done more evaluations. And that develops trust, I think. And then, you know, ultimately, you know, like, what do we value as a staff? You know, we value toughness and like I said, character and production. I think, you know, some of those things of like how competitive are they? If their team's losing, but they're playing well, like, are they happy? You know, that's something we always talk about. How is their body language? Are they, you know, are they, because they played well and their team lost, they come out and they're like, oh, coach, great to see you, right? Like, there's a part of that that needs to be team first. And so I think at the difference at the high school level is that you kind of get who you get. At the college level, we need to be able to have a plan and a clarity of vision of the type of kids we want to get that are high character, talented, and love basketball, and then find those guys in Ohio, you know, and protect Ohio. And Otterbein, I don't know how much you know about our history. I mean, you know, we've had, you know, multiple Final Fours and national championship in 2002, and we're the last OAC school to have a national championship in a really, really, you know, good conference that's usually top four or five in the country every single year. And so, you know, we feel like Otterbein's got a lot to offer. And so, you know, that's got to be a fit both ways. And if it is, We don't need to mass recruit. We don't need to send out a big net and just hope we get anybody. You know, let's go be specific. Let's have a scholarship mindset where we're going after certain specific kids that really fit us in what we're trying to do to make us better.
Once you identify those specific kids that you're looking for and you go out and you see them and you watch them play, how do you balance watching them play with their high school team versus watching them play with their AAU team? Do you value one of those situations more than the other? Are you looking for different things when you see them in those different environments? Just as you're recruiting and you're looking at a player, how do you evaluate them both as a high school player and then in their AAU environment?
Yeah, I think they're both very important from, you know, multiple different levels. One, there's, you know, different coaching styles. Maybe a kid does some stuff really well in AAU because he's allowed to do certain things, but in high school he's maybe more limited in what he's supposed to do or his role. I think AAU is great for, you know, seeing maybe the players, you know, their game as a whole, when high school might be more specific to, you know, the competition or competitive greatness core value that we talk about of doing whatever they need to do for their high school to win. While still talent is still important, but do they have that natural ability in AAU? You know, and then can we develop them with some of our player skill stuff? And then high school, we're really looking for production, yes, but also, you know, they're playing for their school, playing with their buddies and having that competition to really want to win, you know, and do whatever they need to win at that level. And when we go to, you know, Tuesday, Friday, Saturday, we're all out recruiting and my wife, I'm sure, is super happy because we're 3 weeks into our first child. So that's always been, you know, pretty fun timing this up with recruiting and all that. So, but we're out, you know, three, four times a week, you know, catching games, practices. I think what a lot of schools do, you know, at our level, and you have to. But during those times, it's like if we haven't done our homework, we feel like maybe prior to that, you know, we're behind because we're missing on some of the kids where we should be developing relationships by that point.
How do you build the relationships? Forget about with the players, but obviously, if you build those relationships with high school coaches and AAU coaches, and you can get that honest conversation and dialogue going back and forth with those people, it gives you a leg up on being able to identify players who may be a good fit for your program. So how do you make sure that you build the relationship first and then keep the relationship going with those high school and AAU coaches?
Yeah, thankfully for me, growing up in Columbus, I know a ton of them. You know, that was, I think, what was so fortunate. If you look at where I've been coaching, I played at Ohio Wesleyan, which is 30 minutes outside of Columbus. I went to a high school in Columbus. High Dominican, Capital, and Otterbein are all in Columbus. I don't know how that's possible that worked out that way, but I'm very fortunate from, you know, just a relationship. I know a lot of these coaches from that. So those were, you know, pretty easy transitions. And then it's about building trust and them coming to practices and them seeing what we do, you know, inviting AAU coaches, inviting high school coaches to practices and having those relationships where they trust what we're doing, that if they send us a kid, we're doing stuff the right way. And then constantly keeping that open communication of them, you know, seeing a kid and it might not be their kid and giving us a heads up about something, and taking care of them. I held a coaching clinic for high school coaches who came to our shootout. We had like 80 some teams at our shootout over the summer, and I invited them back to come, and I did a clinic on, you know, an open table discussion. I did a quick presentation on what we do, but then about, you know, hey, how can we all get better? Let's bring some ideas to the table and have some discussions. And I think that's important as well, and those relationships is providing value for them, you know, instead of always asking them what they need or what you need from them is, well, hey, what do you guys need?
Yeah, that's a great way to approach it. I think that sometimes in any walk of life, we sometimes get caught up in, we have a lot of time for the people that we think can do something for us.
Exactly.
But we don't always have a lot of time for the people that we don't think can do something
right.
for us.
Right.
And it's very easy to get caught up in that. And I think that's a great way to approach it in that, hey, if it's a two-way street, you're much more likely to be able to develop the kind of relationship that's going to serve both people and help both people to have a better situation, whatever that may be in terms of recruiting. It could be in terms of just improving as a coach whatever it might be. You mentioned a second ago that you are now a new father. So you are not quite yet at the level where you can understand quite how you're going to incorporate your son into your program. But just talk a little bit about the balance between your life as a husband, how important it is to have a supportive spouse with all the time commitment that you have as a coach, and just how you think about that piece of it, basketball and family. Obviously, you grew up in a basketball family. Your dad was a coach, so you had some experience from the kid end of it. How are you thinking about it as a husband and now as a parent?
Well, I think, you know, going through it currently, it's like how can I be the best at all of those that's possible, you know? And I think it's so important to this isn't a job to me. It's a lifestyle, what I'm doing. You know, I tell our guys that, like, I hope they get to the point where they love what they're doing so much it's not a job. And that's what I challenge them to do. And these players are ultimately, you know, part of our family. And my wife, you know, we live 10 minutes away. My wife's over here all the time doing yoga for them because she takes them. They're always happy to see her because they know the yoga session's coming instead of maybe some sprints or
lifting. There you go.
But, you know, how can we incorporate family? My dad comes over and watches practice sometimes and sits up there and gets to know them. With the time commitment as a coach, and you know this, I mean, it's – You have to have a balance, but you have to be able to do both. You have to be able to incorporate your family and Otterbein into one. We had a kid over for Thanksgiving. You just, you know, different family situation, and he came over. And I think more coaches do that stuff. I just think if you're about doing things the right way, you're about relationships, you're about development, no matter how good the kid is playing in that moment or not, is if you're doing stuff the right way and right by the kids, then you can have this big family, you know, this circus, if you want to call it, that all is in the same tent, moving forward together and having a good relationship. And I tell our guys how fortunate I am to have these type of kids around in our program that my son's going to get to look up to. I mean, it got me choked up talking to them. I drove from the hospital to Case Western the next day after my son was born, and that was a mistake. I think my AD even yelled at me. She wasn't very happy about me doing it, and I wasn't ready to coach. I probably really lost them the game. I wasn't prepared, and Case kicked our butt. But long story short, I think, you know, the guy came back from that, and the guys had bought a mini basketball hoop. You know, and I'm sure some of their parents were involved and gave me a card. And it was just like moments like that, you know, make basketballs, you know, were so intense all the time. It's always about, you know, driving to get better. Is that, you know, that meant so much to me from those guys. And I'm so fortunate to have, you know, Max, our son, that's going to be able to look up to those guys when they're programmed. And then as they graduate and continue to come back. And then the next group of guys that come in, and it's just special, and it's why you coach. I mean, it truly is. You know, the results are important, don't get me wrong, but it's about growing and developing. And now as a parent, you know, I talk to the recruits' parents about, you know, what I want for their kids. This is their family away from family. How am I helping them get to where they need to get to in life? How am I making them a better man, father, husband, whatever it is, you know, ultimately over the next 40 years of their career that they're working on, or their family career, whatever it is, how am I doing my job? And basketball is very important. We use that as a tool to get us there. But ultimately, if you don't enjoy the process and this family atmosphere, you know, I don't know how you coach, because that's what's really important.
And the best part is Max is going to have gym access just like you did when you were a kid.
That's right.
Man.
He better have a better jump shot than mine, because I wasn't very good. So
that's good stuff. All right. I want to wrap up with one final question, two-parter. Give me the biggest challenge as you look ahead over the next year or two and you think about where you are right now, where you want to get to, what's the biggest challenge that you have laying in front of you? And then number two, when you get up in the morning and you get out of bed and you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy about being the head men's basketball coach at Otterbein? So your biggest challenge, your biggest joy.
Yeah, I would say the biggest challenge for us is, you know, continuing to like work on our daily habits every single day, as corny as that sounds. I do. I think, you know, recruiting and all that stuff, when you work hard, everything is going to work out. But sometimes, you know, if you get lazy on a day, if you say, okay, well, you know, we're doing well this year or we're not doing well, we got to pick it up. You always need to work at the same level and the same effort and intensity that you have, whether you're winning or losing. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge is maintaining, you know, those daily habits for our program, for our players, for our recruits, you know, for our staff. And then the results will ultimately follow. I would say, the what gets me up in the morning is it's really seeing our guys. Like I love coming to the office and I love, you know, getting my film sessions done and doing all that stuff and then getting them in a skill session or talking to them about how their day's going or seeing the growth in a kid who, like we talked about, that was a freshman or when I took over, some of these guys who are seniors now were sophomores in their development. You know, they weren't one of our guys technically of a recruit, but we had to re-recruit them into our program. Seeing their development over 3 years and how they are as a basketball player, but also as a person, that's what gets me the most joy is seeing the growth and development and then knowing that, hey, here's another class that we get to do that to. And make them, you know, as good of people, students, and players that we can.
That's well said. I think when you think about the opportunity to use basketball as a tool to be able to have an impact on the players that you come in contact with, that's really what it's all about. And I think that's the theme that kind of ran through everything you said tonight is just your passion for the game of basketball and then being able to pass that along and have an impact on the players that you get to work with on a daily basis is critical. Before we get out, Andy, I want to give you a chance to share how can people reach out to you? How can they find out more about you and your program? If you want to share website, social media, email, sure, whatever you feel comfortable. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I'll tell you this. It's funny. When I was young, I was always trying to talk to coaches and, hey, what can I improve on? What can I do this? They always gave me their cell phone and how grateful I was. So my cell phone is 614-579-1373. Call or text me. You're welcome to any practice. Guys can stop by. We can talk or you know, however I can do to help any coaches, young, old, high school, college, whatever I can do to help. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Coach A. Winters. And then my email is winters1@otterbein.edu.
Andy, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule, especially with a newborn son and a wife with a newborn son at home. Really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to jump on with us. It's been a lot of fun getting to know you, learn more about your program at Otterbein. And to everyone out there who's part of our audience, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads presented by Head Start Basketball.